All right, you curious hurly-burlyites. You highly engaged politicos probably know that the hurly-burly's first cousin once removed is Hotel Pacifico, your five-star podcast destination for all things in BC politics and part of the air quotes media universe. Well, today we're bringing the extended family together because our guest is Jeff Meggs, who along with Kate Hammer and Mike McDonald is one of the three fantastic people you can listen to weekly at Hotel Pacifico. Jeff is a decades-long political player in BC, both as an elected official and a backroom strategist. He was chief of staff to Premier Horgan from 2017 until Horgan's retirement in 2022. He served three terms as a member of Vancouver City Council. He was comms director to Premier Glenn Clark, chief of staff to Vancouver Mayor Larry Campbell. And he's a hell of a thinker and writer who contributes regular opinion pieces to our online magazine Quotes and has his own Substack, Lotusland. So who better to talk about what are pretty massive political shifts in BC, drug policy changes, the working people and their relationship with both the NDP and the Conservatives, Horgan's NDP versus EB's NDP versus Singh's NDP. What is going on in British Columbia? There's a lot happening. And what's going on? Cousin Jeff, it's really a pleasure to bring you on the Hurly Burly today. Great to see you.
Great to you, David. And I would just like to reassure your listeners, I have had real jobs as well.
Really? What's one of them?
Well, I was a journalist. That's not a real job. I worked for a long time for the trade union movement. I was an executive director at the BC Fed.
Well, I thought you were going to tell me you worked with your hands at some point.
No, I have to say that's not true. No.
Right. Smooth hands.
Exactly, yeah.
Hey, Canucks beat the Oilers last night. Politics must be taking a back seat to hockey right now.
I know, and the Canucks are putting a lot of surprises at the back end of some of these games. I must say that three-minute craziness a few days ago in the previous series was really something.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, we'll see. It was good.
Doing it without your all-star goalie. It's so impressive.
Yeah. Though they've showed a lot of pluck coming out and doing it time after time. It's great.
All right. Listen, I wanted to talk to you, Jeff, because there have been major developments in BC politics over the last year, but feeling to me like accelerating recently. And I wanted to understand what's going on. I mean, the outcome of the next provincial election is no longer a certain NDP victory. Polyev and the federal Conservatives are running away with BC in an historically unusual way federally. And of course, all the national issues, housing, cost of living, carbon tax, are BC issues. But illegal drug policy also appears to be playing a major role in what's going on in British Columbia. So let's start federally and look at what's going on federally. Conservatives that are at about 50% in the polling consensus about British Columbia. That compares with 33%. In the last federal election. The NDP are at the low end of their norm, between 25 and 30%. And the Liberals, who appeared to have built an enduring base in BC over the last couple of decades, are on the verge of getting wiped out. So what's happening? This has all changed in the last year. What's happening?
Well, I think the federal issues are distinct from the provincial ones, but they're having a big impact provincially, clearly. And I think we're waiting to see really not whether the political foundations have been massively altered, but is there going to be a massive change in who represents those, you know, longstanding currents in BC politics? There has been a huge rise in conservative support, which I don't think anybody can argue with, driven by the success of Pierre Poilievre in attracting votes among working class people, in trying to communicate sort of a common sense, no nonsense approach, a willingness to tackle the prime minister. And he's harnessing a whole lot of support out in British Columbia's resource areas in particular. And when people visualize British Columbia nationally, they should remember that geographically and politically, the Northeast has always been very close to Alberta, the Peace River District. So there's no surprise there. But he's making big gains as well in the whole sort of northern and northwestern swath of the province, and we'll see how far that takes him. He recruited a very interesting candidate named Ellis Ross, an Indigenous leader from Kitimat, which was a coup. Ellis Ross is widely respected, and he's a bit of an outlier in terms of Indigenous leadership and his refusal to sign up for some of the legislation that was passed unanimously in British Columbia for the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People and so on. But that's not to say he's not broadly respected, and he's certainly going to have an impact, I think, in the North. Whether he produces a big turnout from Indigenous communities as a vote, a block vote, I think is a very different question. And that's another problem for the party of Conservatives, is making sure they get all their new friends out to vote. So it's looking great in the polls right now, but there's a fair amount of time to go. And in BC, like the rest of Canada, the battlegrounds are increasingly in cities and suburbs and not so much in rural areas. So I think we're going to have to wait and see as well what happens in the downtown and in the suburbs, where provincially as well, there's been a lot of swinging back and forth.
So, but you're talking about Poilievre attracting voters that the Conservatives traditionally do not attract. Indigenous people, for one thing. Working people in northern resource towns, for another thing. So what is drawing those people from the New Democrats?
Well, they were already, only the New Democrats have got good support in BC, but we're not seeing a big, I think the number of seats are vulnerable to the Conservatives in BC federally, in part because the incumbents, who are long-standing successful politicians like Richard Canning's, have decided to retire, which is the normal, you know, course of transition. Another one who's leaving is Randall Garrison in Souk, which is sort of hard by Victoria to the west, but historically fairly resource-oriented. There's a great candidate been picked to run there named Maya Tate, who was the mayor of Souk, or at least she's declared she's going to be the candidate, wants to be the candidate. So I think that, you know, rumors of the NDP's demise in some of these ridings are premature. But one on the North Coast is an interesting one, because the person stepping back there is Rachel Blaney, who has been successful on a couple of occasions. But the person who seeks to replace her for the Conservatives is a guy named Aaron Gunn, who's got a very successful, what I would call sort of alt-right social media presence with a lot of followers. He was rejected by the BC Liberals, as they then were, to be their leader, because they were uncomfortable with his positions on a number of points. So having been passed over, or actually repudiated as a possible candidate, he's now got the nomination in North Island. And when you look at Aaron Gunn's work, I think it's quite interesting to see what he's doing, because it points to some problems for the progressive or center-left side of the spectrum, because the Conservatives are playing a type of politics which I think are excellent, to be honest. It's a full-spectrum approach. So Gunn is a so-called independent journalist. He makes YouTube documentaries about the plight of resource workers, which are credible and deal with issues that those folks are actually raising. He usually winds up with a conclusion that the federal government, and of course in the case of the fisheries, it's a federal responsibility, is 100% responsible, and that Prime Minister Trudeau was probably sitting up late at night trying to pick the wings off the flies of people in resource communities. He also holds rallies and gets out in the community and does a lot of work. So he's present very much in social media. He's present in big events that make people feel kind of welcome and included. And he generally stays away from, really wrong-headed statements about identity politics and that kind of thing. So, you know, this is a new style, I think, or it's a revival of some old stuff in a new setting, which is very powerful and is going to be a big threat to anybody who's not prepared to play hardball in all of those parts of the political spectrum. This is not going to be a campaign where you just go door knocking and hope the leaflet's effective. That would be deadly. And as many guests on your show have said, Corey Tenike and you and others, it's a social media battle now. And I think the Conservatives have very effectively harnessed a tremendous amount of anxiety and frustration that's present in social media and are mobilizing it. And that's showing up in the polls. Whether it will show up in the big poll is a different question.
Okay. So on the national level, the analysis of vote movement appears to be that the NDP are losing a significant number of votes to Poilievre and are roughly replacing them with votes from the Liberals. Right. And so that's why their standing in the national polls is similar, even though in key areas they've lost votes to Poilievre. I've got a few questions about this, but the first one is, I assume that's also what's happening in BC. Like, the Liberals are down substantially, the Conservatives are up substantially, the NDP are roughly where they were. But I find it hard to believe it's Liberal votes fleeing to Poilievre. And I assume it is the kind of work, the kind of voters the NDP attract that the Liberals have never been able to attract, that Poilievre is stealing from the NDP, and the NDP are probably stealing some downtown votes from the Liberals.
Well, I want to respond in a, sort of a bigger picture way and then come back to BC briefly, because I have a view about our party federally, which I don't hear very much, but I'd like to say it here, which is that we really should be in a very optimistic and high upbeat time, because at this point in the history of the country, every province except, I think, New Brunswick and Quebec is a different case, has had an NDP government or opposition, and most have had NDP governments. So a very large share of the population has a parent, a brother, a sister, a cousin, whatever, who have actually voted or thought about voting NDP. And in the Coletto poll, which I think came out this week and you may be referencing, it's clear that a big share of Canadians, and this would be especially true in BC, are open to the NDP as a voting option. So while the number is the same and has been steady, it hasn't declined, and Jagmeet Singh's been able to foster that through this long and complicated period, there's a big, big opportunity there for the right sort of politics. The problem for the NDP is that those politics play a bit differently in every part of the country, and also that you know, financially and in other ways, we're underpowered compared to certainly to the Conservatives, as are the federal Liberals these days. In the BC case, we have a big caucus. About half the federal caucus is from BC. We've got, a mature, very healthy movement out here that's quite prepared to work in either field, federal or provincial. And we'll talk a bit about the provincial situation. We have a huge amount of support in BC, and we've had that for many, many years. So we're starting from a good place here, and I think we'll have strong candidates. What Poilievre has done that I think is really distinctive is he has decided that if the Conservatives are going to break out of the cul-de-sac they found themselves in for this last period of time, they're going to actually need average people's votes, and they can't be a corporate sector party. And that's turning out to be a cold shower for a lot of people on our side of the spectrum who thought we could take those people for granted, and we can't. The difficulty for the center-left is that it's tended to, privately at least, see working-class votes as kind of either to be had for sure, but not necessarily courted, particularly if it meant uncomfortable discussions in some parts of
politics.
Well,
we're obviously acting in their best interest, and the Conservatives are obviously not, and they should just understand that, right?
Well, exactly. And if we're spending a lot of time discussing carbon policy when they have absolutely no choice but to drive to a job that's a long way away, we still expect them to pay up, you know. So I think a lot of policy options that have been, you know, cherished by people like us have not been that important, or have been actually a distraction as far as a lot of working people are concerned, and Poilievre's picking up on that. The other thing is that people are very frustrated in BC as elsewhere about how certain things don't seem to work, and we can debate about whether or not it's fundamentally broken. But a lot of stuff is not working very well, and I think that's been a pretty big problem provincially, and Poilievre is capitalizing on that. So he's kind of a nasty, tough guy who says, I'm going to provide you with more security. I want you to be sitting on the porch, drinking the coffee, congratulating yourself on your kids getting into an apprenticeship program. That's absolutely great, and I'm for that, and I'm going to be really tough to make sure we get that to happen. And so that's reassuring for a lot of people who aren't hearing that kind of reassurance elsewhere.
Right. Are you worried, though? And let's stick with the federal situation because I think it's different. But are you worried that at the end of this process, the federal NDP may have come back with the same number of votes they got last time?
Well, we always
may
worry.
Have come back with the same number of seats they have last time, but that they're different people and that the party is different and that the party has been effectively downtowned.
Well, there's a lot of questions there.
Yeah.
Of course, I worry that an election turns out badly. I mean, if we go...
No, but I'm not talking... Okay, I'm not even presuming the result. But, like, you just outlined something, and Poilievre and Singh are not even competing on the same territory in terms of issues and play. And you said Poilievre is hitting those people. And so We can see what's happening in the polls. So yes, something could happen and change. But if something doesn't change, it looks like the NDP caucus would be quite different from what it is now.
Well, it could be. I think the I don't agree with some of the comments I've heard you make in other settings, David, that, you know, dental care is irrelevant or that the pharmacare change is irrelevant. I think the vote that happened the other day where the Conservatives tried to stop the pharmacare thing is a help to Singh. I think there are things that NDP candidates can say on the doorstep that are relevant to people. And you can say, oh, no, actually, free contraception is going to happen. Those are good things and good gains. Mm-hmm. Will they be sufficient in the battle to come? It's difficult to say, but I'm not panicking the way some people would have us panic. What I think happened to the NDP federally, which was the point I was going to make earlier, is that with Jack Layton, and you were very close to a lot of that stuff, Layton came on the scene. He had took two or three elections before he started to really attract some attention. And it was his fourth outing when he finally got opposition status and tragically died. But the thing that always struck me about that cycle was that because of the minority governments, the NDP was able to run for office four times in a 10-year period, which almost never happens in Canadian politics. Yeah. And Jack was able to do strategic things federally, which I think Jagmeet and his team are going to have to look hard at. He made forays into Quebec. He attracted a key candidate there in Tom Mulcair. He used his connections with municipal leaders to recruit a lot of new candidates. And those were specific circumstances that made it possible for him to take a national vision and apply it. I think the challenge for Jagmeet is that the federal party membership don't have that kind of national vision anymore. They're not worried about whether we get seats in Quebec. And I've heard Brian Topp on your program say there's no way without seats in Quebec. So the difficulty for Jagmeet is that a party which nationally has very strong provincial sections has a hard time forging a national vision that would be effective, especially against somebody like Poilievre, who's got his own difficulties in Quebec, but nothing to speak of compared to the NDP.
Right. Competition, competitive fire, compete level. It's mid-spring in Canada, Stanley Cup playoffs. Flip on any sports media, every third sentence features a variation on the word. Into that glut, I offer these observations on competition, but from an entirely different arena. And for you hurly-burlyites who pay close attention to these ads, I'll just note that's a pun inside a segue. Not shockingly, it's the world of telecom. Even less shockingly, they're from our presenting sponsor, TELUS. First, some fresh data. Because of a more competitive landscape in Ontario, which I'll come back to in about 30 seconds, internet prices there are falling, 7.2% in March, over 26% in the last 12 months. When we widen the aperture, and you might have seen this quoted in the federal budget, StatsCan reports cell phone plan rates have declined 50% since December 2018. Also from StatsCan, while overall inflation ticked up to 2.9% in March from 2.8% in February, cell phone prices continued to fall, now 26% cheaper year-on-year than March 2023. Back to Ontario and their falling internet prices. There's a reason for it. New entrants into the competitive landscape, like Koodo, one of TELUS's flanker brands. Pre-Koodo internet in Ontario, wireline prices were historically stable, a fancy way of saying they didn't get any cheaper. That all began to change last October. Fact is, companies like Koodo, who invest in new markets and put real skin in the game, are best equipped to offer innovative service packages and price promotions and bring sustainable competition. TELUS isn't shy about it. They've already made a difference in Ontario. They want to make a bigger difference for more customers east. Compete harder. To sum that up, I'll just borrow the perfect words of the late, very great Bob Cole, the soundtrack of so many Stanley Cup playoffs. Oh, baby. Okay, so let's move to the provincial scene, which has been as striking in a way. There's a provincial election this fall, am I correct?
There is, October the 19th.
So not long ago, everybody on the Curse of Politics, including Corey, would have agreed that David Eby was safe as houses, right? And now we have polls that show this fledgling Conservative Party nipping at their heels in the polls. Is this surging conservatism in BC, or is this a stumbling NDP government?
Well, there's, I think the jury's out, although the two most recent polls, one, you know, has to be credible coming from Dimitri Pantazopoulos, who's credible. People often cast some shade over the mainland research out, you know, results, but they're showing this continuing surge for the Conservatives. I mean, we can talk about how real it is and then how possible it is for the Conservatives to capitalize on it. What I don't think is changing is that the electorate in BC is basically split down the middle. It's always had a right half and a left half. And the magic for Conservative forces or right-of-center forces was to make sure, as a guest on our program said, that the party in charge understands its prime directive is no NDP, not the NDP. And we asked Jess Ketchum about what was social credit, the right-wing option for many years. He just said, well, not NDP. Right. If you understood those two, you know, not NDP, if you got that part, then you were an excellent participant in that organization. And so that's been the key objective, was to stop the NDP from forming power ever since it was the CCF in 1933 and got opposition status on its first outing. So I think what...
Saskatchewan's the same, by the way, Jeff, right? Like, yeah. I mean, there's been the... Ever since Douglas, there's been the NDP, and then there's been either the Liberals, the PCs, or the SAS party, which is the not NDP party.
Right? Well, and I think here in BC, and you know more about this than I do, the federal Liberal option, which was much bigger deal when I moved to BC in the late 70s than it is today, you got a revival under Justin Trudeau, but the presence and importance of federal Liberalism in BC has been waning, and federally the NDP's always been able to count on support from federal Liberals in certain ridings where they thought that was the best way to defeat the Conservatives. What we see provincially is a strong attraction by federal Liberals to participate provincially as New Democrats, provided that the NDP is not presenting itself in some way that makes them deeply uncomfortable. So that's going to be the big question coming up next. I think will for years, and the BC Liberals, as they then were, actually had a federal Liberal in a critical position in leadership, whether it was Gordon Campbell, who had strong federal Liberal ties, or Christy Clark, whose federal ties were very obvious, even Andrew Wilkinson, who presided over the 2020 election defeat at the hands of John Horgan. Now Kevin Falcon has come along and said, we're not Liberals. And that instinct is understandable given what we see happening in the polls. But the name Conservative was taken and by a group that hadn't won anything for years but kept the lights on and the photocopier warmed up. Suddenly, he fired John Rustad, a pretty well-respected Northern MLA, with what Kevin Falcon thought were sort of wrong views on climate change. And the irony is, and it was the best firing that John Rust had ever had, because he just crossed over to the Conservatives, and now he's a powerhouse, apparently. So we have to see how that plays out. I think the prospects for the right uniting are very low before the election.
Right.
And so from a David Eby standpoint, although he's had some tough weeks in the last few weeks, his strategic position remains very good. There's no reason to be complacent about it, but right. I'm not certain at all that the Conservatives could put together a machine that would be as effective as what we saw in the past from people like Gordon Campbell.
So what's your guess about how things are shaping up? And I'm prepared to get into what BC United did to themselves and what the impact of that is, but I'm certain, as you are, that there will be two right-wing parties, at least two right-wing parties in the next election. But the NDP were counting on a split vote between those two things. How split will that vote end up being? I mean, at this point, 6 months out, it looks like BC United are down to 15, 17 points. So are they even going to be able to hold that through a campaign?
Well, that's a really important question, and I don't really know the answer. I don't know if anybody does. If I could be disrespectful to the Conservatives for a moment, which there's usually time for that
on
the show.
Go ahead, Jerry.
You know, John Rustad has recruited another MLA named Bruce Bamman, who was the mayor of Abbotsford. Bruce Bamman decided to try to deal with homelessness in Abbotsford by getting civic workers to dump chicken manure where people were trying to pitch their tents. I mean, he's had some controversial positions on certain things and had to step back from them. We don't know who else is being recruited in there. The Conservatives are far, far behind in money raising. And some of the people that they've got who are organizers have recently had a turn in civic politics on the right side of the spectrum, where the party completely disappeared. And Ken Sim, the current mayor of Vancouver, set up a whole new party to avoid having to spend time with some of those folks. I'm sure they're getting on Twitter right now to tell me how wrong I am. But, you know, I look at that group and I go, it's a monumental challenge they're undertaking to weld together a party under these circumstances in the time frame available to them. And the polling is very encouraging. But will they get there? I think afterwards, and Mike McDonald and I debate this a bit, it'll be interesting to see how many seats were achieved by the two parties, because it's hard for me to visualize the BC United going up in smoke, given the resources that are there. Kevin Falcon is a bit like yesterday's man in BC politics. He spent years and years in the front bench as a critical right arm of Gordon Campbell, but then was turned down for leadership after Campbell had to resign. And he's clearly not at ease, in my view, in the new environment. However, he has great loyalists. This is it for him. He's got his back to the wall, personally and politically. He's got a significant amount of money, and he's a very smart man, very determined and smart. So how is it going to turn out for him? I don't know, but he's not about to just throw up his hands.
Can I be cynical about you for a second? In yeah. Saskatchewan in the 70s, when the Liberals were falling from their perch as the challengers to the NDP, the alternative to the NDP, falling into the shitter, and the Conservatives were passing them in exactly the same way that this is happening in British Columbia, the NDP for several elections went to great lengths to both rhetorically and sometimes in operationally prop up the Liberal Party in order to sustain those splits. And I can hear you talking up the BC United, because Falcon's a dud. And yeah, they have resources, and they're spending them right now as they are collapsing. They're on the air with television ads. They've got way more money than the Conservatives, and they're just getting blown out. It's over for those people, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like it. And I have to say, I'm not, you know, I'm not crying into my coffee in the morning when I wake up and read the news, but is it going to be as, you know, does that produce 80 seats, which some of the 338 Canada poll, you know, numbers suggest, or does it produce a lesser number? I think the challenge for the EB campaign is to demonstrate that continued connection to actually what people are thinking and worrying about. Yesterday, they announced a $110 rebate from auto insurance. That's about the third or fourth time that's happened. EB's been very associated with the auto insurance reforms, and it's at least double what people think they may be paying in carbon tax this year in the increase. So, you know, they're making some important moves on that front. And I think that the NDP organizationally and politically is in the best shape that almost anybody can remember. So we'll see the campaigns that the NDP will mount, and some of those swing ridings, particularly in the suburbs, are going to be very effective. But I do think that some of our candidates in rural areas are going to face tremendous pressure from the Conservatives, and the Liberals are going to disappear completely. So whether that, you know, does that leave two parties at the end that might hold the balance of power if they could speak to each other? I guess it's possible. There's still 5 months to go.
It's more likely they'll split the vote and get blown out by EB, but yeah, they'll be... What will be left will be a united conservative movement in a different
way. Well, and the other thing we haven't mentioned, and I don't propose that you spend any time dwelling on it, is the Green Party. But when John Horgan came to power in a very difficult and tricky negotiation over a period of time, it was with the Green Party, who now probably will be lucky to hang on to one seat on Vancouver Island. They've not become a factor in Canadian politics, and not even in BC politics, which is an interesting thing in itself.
I wasn't going to bring him up because Jenny Byrne beat it into me about 4 years ago that I was spending way too much time thinking and talking about the Green Party and that it really didn't matter. She turns out to have been right.
Yeah.
So down in Clinton, Ontario, an hour north of London, there's a place called Sloman Park, and in it sits a single rail car. It's a strange little rail car, unlike anything in the CN fleet to which it once belonged. When you step inside this meticulously restored bit of railway history, which you can easily do because it's open to the public for visits, you'd swear you just stepped into a school classroom. And that would be because you did. For more than 40 years, from 1926 to 1967, it and six other rail cars like it rolled around Northern Ontario, reaching students in remote mining towns. The rail cars delivered basic education in five-day sessions once a month. They brought medicine and supplies. They even dispensed civics lessons to first-generation immigrants working in the deeps. The teachers in the school cars, as they were known, lived on the trains with their families. One of the most dedicated was Fred Sloman, the teacher on school car number one. Sloman was a pedagogical nomad for most of his life, traveling between Sudbury, Caprile, and Foyllet. He and his wife, Sheila, raised five children aboard the trains. There's a picture in the Ontario archives that captures the harshness and the hope of the time. A group of kids trooping out of a solitary icicle-encrusted school car, wading through deep snow, clutching their book bags. When the school cars moved on to the next towns, Sloman and his fellow teachers would leave students with 3 weeks of homework. It's a completely Canadian story, and it happened on the rail lines of our sponsor, CN. Fred Sloman was an ordinary Canadian hero, and now he has a public park in Clinton named after him, with his school car parked in it. He deserves to be remembered. One of the really peculiar things about BC right now, and it's a, such a peculiar thing about Polyev and his approach. I have never seen a federal leader of the opposition campaigning against a premier before. And Polyev has decided that his opponent in BC is not really Jagmeet Singh, not really Justin Trudeau. It's David Eby. Mm-hmm. And he's going after Eby all the time. Right? And how much damage is he doing to him?
Well, I don't think he's doing very much. But I think the issues that Polyev wants to fight on are ones where David Eby's been prepared to have the fight. And the two that come to mind are drug policy and carbon tax.
Right.
I mean, the carbon tax goes way back in BC to Gordon Campbell days. It's been part of the wallpaper, but it's getting to the point now where I think it remains a critical question for the NDP strategically how they manage that issue going into the campaign. I mean, it's the tides run out on the carbon tax in many ways. So I think the auto insurance change is part of that response. Drug policy, we could spend more time on, but it's helpful for Polyev, I think, to do that. And I think in northern BC in particular, in some of those areas, he's mobilizing and speaking to a lot of his base who generally are frustrated by what they see as a despicable coalition between New Democrats and Liberals to keep life going to hell. And, you know, Jagmeet, he is not that high profile. David Eby's nearby, so, you know, why not?
Right. Well, I mean, David Eby and Justin Trudeau seem more in sync intellectually than any other premier is with Justin Trudeau. And right. I'm not saying they're buddies or they're close friends, but a lot of the ideas that the federal Liberals are pursuing seem to have emerged from David Eby's government in the first instance. There's a copacetic-ness there between the two, and they're not hostile. They've got good relations. Is that hurting Eby? Is he seen as too close to Trudeau at a time when people in BC apparently really want to run him out of town?
Well, I don't think that Eby is seen as close to Trudeau the way some people paint Jagmeet as close to Trudeau, and I don't feel that in the political environment here. I mean, we periodically have our fights and frustrations, and you know, there's always some tension between provincial sections of the NDP and the federal section as well. But I would say currently there are no issues, and there's a lot that the federal Liberals would like to do in certain areas that can be done and demonstrated on the ground here in BC if they get behind it. Like one is natural gas policy and supporting the development of the natural gas sector, which is kind of an energy positive approach that both parties had supported, as opposed to the more difficult, you know, oil sands exports and the TMX pipeline. So electrification, climate change, all of that kind of stuff and the investments around it are something you can do easily here with Eby. Child care was another one, which both levels wanted to do and have done. Eby's under fire here for not getting it done fast enough, but nobody's proposing it be canceled.
Right.
You know, I think that the cost and difficulty of launching some of these programs was underestimated by lots of people. But yeah, when you want someone to stand with you who's a bit more aligned, certainly Eby's very valuable to Justin Trudeau that way. And at the same time, Eby can make a lot of gains with the investments that are coming as a result of that relationship.
Right. Do you see any vulnerabilities or openings in the Polyev juggernaut?
Well, I think The main one would come from a complete overhaul of how the conversation occurs with working people. And I think that that's, I think Polyev has been successful in saying and doing certain things that are counterintuitive and therefore resonate more. You know, he writes an open letter to corporate people saying kind of obvious advice. You should have public support before you come and ask me for help. But who among us in the political class hasn't wanted to say that to the business community or some other stakeholder at some point? You know, like don't call me, call somebody who can vote, right? Yeah. And I think that more of that would be good. I think there's been maybe a rhetorical problem in terms of some of Jagmeet's interventions because he uses terminology that just sounds a bit more Ottawa than it does workplace, right? And right. Polyev has really mastered that stuff. But on the other hand, and I'll probably get the difficulties for saying this, but there are certain things that are hard for some parties to say and easy for others, and it's hard to predict when. You know, Thomas Mulcair famously gets blindsided by Justin Trudeau because Mulcair is going to balance the budget and Trudeau won't. But I don't know if I ever would have been in a meeting with Thomas Mulcair giving advice saying, blow your brains out on your proposed budget. I don't think I would have given that advice, and I don't think he would have taken it. You know, the same thing when I was asked to advise Horgan in the platform.
Trudeau could do that because Martin had existed.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that because Stephen Harper seemed to be so corporate and so indifferent to the plight of normal people, Polyev is contrasting that. And even apparently voted for the anti-scab law in the first reading, which I thought was interesting. We'll see what he does later. I mean, there's a difference between being pro-worker and being pro-labor. And there's a point at which working people, in my view, say, hey, if you're attacking unions, even if I'm not a union member, that's not good for me. Like, I don't want you to be able to break strikes. And even when they were rolling back other labor code changes here in BC, the provincial Liberals did not touch the anti-scab law. To me, that's a very important line that Polyev will have to cross if he wants any credibility, and the CLC and Canadian Labour Congress are trying to do that. I do think New Democrats could be, and I think Horgan, of course, I'm a huge fan. We worked together for those 5 years. He had a great comfort. He was comfortable in his skin being pro-union and pro-worker at the same time. And he made some very strong pro-union statements when he was seeking the leadership that were, you know, hot-button issues here in BC, policy issues that it would take too long to explain, but said to people, okay, that's enough of the triangulation, enough of the shilly-shallying. He's actually with us. And I think that it's hard for Trudeau, but easier for Jagmeet to make some of those statements and find a way to resonate with people on that front.
Right. Well, you know, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about the way Polyev is reshaping some issues. So you talked about the Indigenous thing, right? Mm-hmm. I would say for the last decade, if not longer, maybe forever, the Conservatives have conceded the Indigenous file as it was understood in Canada to the left. And have not attempted to compete really in that territory. And Polyev isn't competing by matching Liberal spending on Indigenous issues or talking about the same issues that Trudeau is. He's recruiting different types of Indigenous people to run, serious, high-profile Indigenous people who have credibility to run, who have a different point of view and aren't the AFN point of view. And so it's going to be much more difficult, for example, to say to Canadians that the Conservatives don't care about reconciliation if they've got prominent Indigenous people running for them and they're proposing a different way that maybe sounds like it might make sense. Maybe people think property rights make sense. Maybe when some of these shibboleths are challenged, they don't hold water, right? I think the same thing is true with working people. He's not running away from these issues. He's attacking core areas of the other party's strengths.
No, I agree. And I think that, you know, the issue always for Indigenous people was, in British Columbia, for the national audience, of course, we don't have treaties over most of the territory. It's a very different place. And we wound up making a series of decisions to acknowledge that was the fact and spend some time dealing with the issues on the ground as opposed to trying to get treaties, which was taking forever, and some want to do, but most don't want to. What's happening now is we see, especially in the North, that First Nations are saying, if we're going to have self-government and self-determination, which everybody thinks is a good idea, we need money, we need revenue, we need to be able to do certain things and make decisions and implement them. And for that, we're going to need resource rents. So we're seeing a big sea change now where, especially in the North, First Nations are not only desirable to have on board, but absolutely necessary to have on board. So the argument about whether or not there's consent and do they get to agree, it's kind of like without them, you're hopeless.
Right.
So that's a fundamental change, which a lot of people are missing, I think, in the broader public, but not Poilievre. And Ellis Ross, very much an exemplar of that kind of approach, because he was very involved in getting the first pipeline, the natural gas pipeline that's going to Kitimat. But there are other areas where I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the Conservatives going to do? I've been one for years who thought childcare was a crucial, crucial thing. I mean, we were often told in our strategy sessions that if we wanted to get more votes, we needed to combine issues that had women, pocketbook, daily life kind of thing. So I would always shout childcare, and they'd say, well, it doesn't poll well. You know, I think that childcare is not just symbolic, it's critical for people who are with young families. And my hope is that it becomes part of just the economic structure of the country for a whole set of reasons we don't need to dwell on here. Will Poilievre say I'm against childcare? I really doubt it. Would he say he's going to cut it? I don't think so. But I think that his opponents need to force him out on those points. Because we know that historically, we've seen big trouble in terms of privatization, the rollback of social services, attacks on healthcare. And so if Poilievre is not prepared to support a bill which, while it has some cost, is providing free contraception, that's a problem for him. And I think that it's a wedge that could be widened. So those are the kinds of debates that will have to be forced. He can't carry on forever just putting out brilliant zingers and not speaking to some of the core issues that matter to Canadian families. And in the suburbs, those will be things like investment in transit, childcare, a whole bunch of things like that.
Could I be the guy that one of those guys in the room that rains on your parade about childcare? I did so much polling.
I was baiting you, to be honest.
I've done so much polling on this over the years, and it is a sad reality that the only people in the country who care enough about childcare, it's broadly supported as an idea, but the only people who care enough about it to conceivably cast a vote about it are women who have children who need childcare right now. Mm-hmm. Not men in any age group or any circumstance, and not women once they've aged out of that or before that. So it's a very, very small actual voting block. And I think we can see that in the sense that the Liberals have delivered a very large amount of money and a very large national program of childcare, and they're losing the female vote to Poilievre.
Well, I don't know if they're losing it for that reason. I think that they can.
Well, I don't know. They're not winning it because of that reason. I didn't say they were losing it because of that reason, but they're not winning it because they did that.
Yeah, but if you can't, I think, and this is, we're talking about the NDP today. Leighton, said, I'm going to form government. He was sitting at 30 seats. After the laughter died down, he said, no, I mean it. I'm really going to form government. If you don't have that approach, if you're not willing to contest for power and actually make some changes while you have some access to power, then just leave. Don't bother us with this. No, don't, get out of the way. This is the struggle that the NDP has federally, but it doesn't have it so much provincially. And these are some of the things that I think are going to be looked back on provincially as critical hallmarks. So the federal Liberals are involved in that. Poilievre on some of these key questions. I don't share your view that it's such a narrow group that are interested and concerned. I think it's more than that. And changes are being made in that vein. There's a whole series of issues provincially which, the provincial party can go back on. Investments which, item by item would poll just like you say childcare polls. But taken together make a commitment and a statement to working people
that
which
I believe
has to be responded to, right? So, it's the total package.
But that narrative does not exist in Canadian politics right now, Jeff, that you're talking about. Well, that alternative narrative to working people that sums up all of this
totally
not out there.
Well, that's what I was groping for in my comment. I do think that there's a challenge ahead for Chicmeade and the NDP. So we've said the polling shows there's an opportunity there. There's an audience that's open to it. But you've got to find the way to speak through and break and break through and speak to it. And I think also, you know, provincially, there's always been a lot of boosterism and pride and a history of populism in BC. It's not a dirty word here. I mean, you know, we've had non-populist premiers, but the most interesting ones have been populist every time, whether it was Glenn Clark or Bill Vandersam, who was a very populist and wacky guy. And now we see, in some respects, the Proliev factor, because Rustad's not as not in Proliev's class when it comes to political skills, casting that stone at Kevin Falcon, who's also not really a populist. And I think that's the other problem for those guys, is that Falcon is a developer. He has a kind of a downtown style to him. And Rustad seems like the kind of guy who actually, you know, genial type, like to be him around. But Eby's got a great package to sell. And he's got a vision of what he thinks the province should be. I think that needs to be done nationally. And one of the problems in national politics is that we're really not sure what Canada should be anymore, but it's definitely not what it was.
Right.
And there's a sense of loss about that and frustration that certain basic tasks can't seem to get done, and Poilievre is harnessing that.
Okay. Okay, can we spend a few minutes on harm reduction and illegal drug policy?
Yeah, we could spend years on it, I guess.
I know. I'm going to warn you, I don't know anything about it. I mean, I'm a big believer in recreational drugs, but I'm afraid of needles. So I've not been caught up in this. But you have written very thoughtfully about this on your Substack, Lotus Land. Can you summarize the recent history of this issue for us? Because there's a lot of moving parts now.
Well, British Columbia, for reasons that I've been troubled by, I don't have the answers, was one of the first, and by far had the worst, fentanyl crises in North America. And we went in 2016 from a relatively small number of overdose deaths that were mostly driven by heroin to seeing that fentanyl was coming into the drug supply. And it took off almost exponentially, to the point where now overdose deaths due to the toxic drugs is the leading cause of death across all the demographics, which is a staggering thing to say since it, we only declared the emergency in 2016. And so I have wondered why this wasn't, it's a huge issue in public policy, but it's not really a huge political issue for a whole set of reasons that have to do with the blame that we place on addicts for getting addicted and so on. But BC's also been distinctive way back in a bipartisan way to Larry Campbell, who I worked with. It was a critical issue here in BC when he was the coroner. Some people maybe remember him from being the inspiration for the coroner in Da Vinci's inquest. But Larry, now retired, was a Mountie, had worked as a NARC, a narcotics officer, and ran for mayor on a harm reduction approach, or a four pillars approach, we called it in those days, which said we're going to deal with our overdose crisis that existed at the time due to injection drug use on the basis of four pillars. One is prevention, one is treatment, one is enforcement, and the last pillar is harm reduction, which would be reducing the harm caused by the use of drugs, sort of a practical interim mitigating approach. And the main thing we did, and that Larry got, thanks to his relationship with federal ministers at the time, was an exemption so that Vancouver had the first supervised injection site in North America where people in the downtown east side could inject in safety, and no one has died as an overdose as a result of that intervention. So harm reduction became, you know, in the wake of needle exchanges and then the supervised injection site and other initiatives and fights with the Harper government and so on, but it became kind of the critical piece that happened in BC, arguably at the expense of the other pillars. And when fentanyl came along, we wound up with a huge crisis on our hands where people were dying at the rate of 6 or 7 a day, and still are. And we have a lot of gang conflict, and about 40% of our murder rate is driven by targeted shootings. Never mind all the shootings that occur where people don't die, which are scary enough. People spring automatic rifle fire at each other and so on. And we've got used to it, and we sort of roll along, I would say, although it's a constant subtext. More recently, and this is crucial for Poilievre and so on, at the recommendation of everybody, including support from the police chiefs and so on, the government decided to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of drugs, including some of these fentanyl drugs, And in the public's mind, this caused an outbreak of really bad street disorder. And so when you hear Polyev saying, when will we end the WACO policy by the WACO Prime Minister, he's referring to the federal government's willingness to provide exemptions to BC to have this decriminalization policy. That's all a long way of saying, in my own view, this is a crucial, crucial question in so many ways. I mean, many places in Canada now have visible addiction in the street, people unable to function, homeless, and suffering terribly. But no really coherent strategy to deal with it. BC's tried the hardest, and the Premier, I think wisely, a week or so ago, appealed to Canada, to Ottawa, to revise the decriminalization initiative so that people would not be allowed to use drugs publicly. But that more or less guts the entire initiative. And so what I think is happening here, and Polyev is making the most out of it, is that we've kind of hit a wall in terms of our response to this drug crisis in a number of ways. And more Canadian communities, not just BC communities, are struggling with it. Marshall Smith, who's out of BC, had a long, very serious brush with addiction himself and has now recovered, is Daniel Smith's chief of staff.
Yeah.
In Alberta, and they're driving a different
approach. You had him on Hotel Pacifico.
Yeah, we had him on, and their approach is much more treatment-focused, not without its own consequences. But, you know, I think if you polled on should we provide treatment for for drug addicts, you'd get a very broad support. And if you get down to specifics in terms of the cost, it's really families who are facing this crisis, losing loved ones, struggling with loved ones who are addicted, who would be very, very seized with this. And the cost is in the billions. And unlike childcare, it's not really clear exactly what you should do. So I think this is going to become a bigger issue, politically. It has to. If the job of government is to provide security and safety and dignity for its citizens, especially when they're in crisis, then we're not there yet in BC. And the solutions are extremely political and divisive. So Polyev is really, really working this one hard. It's also something that the fellow I mentioned earlier, Aaron Gunn, who is running in North Island for the Conservatives, has made a big issue out of. And for average people, I mean working people, for working families, the presence of this around them in their community is disturbing and upsetting, and they want someone to take care of it. And deal with it. But they don't want to necessarily, think more very far down the road of what that would entail or the tremendous costs that I think are going to be involved. So that's my short lecture on that. It's a huge moral and ethical problem for government. And Polyev knows that, and he's proposing certain answers, which I think are going to resonate with a lot of people, in some respects, regrettably. I agree with some of his concerns, though.
So the public opinion blowback that EB's feeling from this issue, is it about the number of people dying? Is it about public fear of crime? Or is it a clash of values in terms of how one deals with addicts?
Well, I think it's the conflict and disturbance that occurs when you see this profound illness right in front of you. And it was here in BC, it was in parks, schoolyards, even in hospitals, people were saying there was people openly using, smoking fentanyl and other drugs. It was an idea that we've tolerated this death toll, which continues to rise for a long time. The fact that it continues to rise while we continue to advance harm reduction raises a question in a lot of people's minds. If harm reduction is the answer, why are we still doing it? Because it's not working. But harm reduction was intended to mitigate the impacts of addiction on the individual and on society while we did prevention, treatment, and enforcement. I spent a bunch of time looking into the enforcement side because British Columbia also, regrettably, is excellent at supporting organized crime networks for a whole set of reasons. And we have this murder rate and a whole set of other issues, and I've talked to a lot of police about it, and we need to do a ton more on that front. But that's not the first resort of people on the center left when it comes to dealing with any policy issue. Let's talk to the police, right? treatment, should you abstain? Should you have methadone and some kind of drug support? Should you be detained and forced to detoxify? These are all profound questions which are not settled, and yet a treatment program is supposed to exist. And it's not like an illness that, like a broken arm, where I'm going to head into the emergency ward, they're going to slap on a cast, and I'll be okay. It's all of those. It really goes to the core of who we are as a society, and why we think some of these problems are occurring, and then the prevention side. You can say with some degree of accuracy that people in certain circumstances are more vulnerable to addiction. It's not a fate or a destiny. You know, you, me, and my brother could be brought up the same way, and I could have a serious addiction issue, and my brother won't.
Right.
This is a nightmare for policymakers and for politicians. People would prefer the whole thing just go away. And I think it's becoming more and more visible. And it's not easy to just stick it back in a box. Very, very difficult.
What will the consequences be of moving toward a more tough love approach?
Well, if tough love means, you're addicted and I'm going to slam you in a treatment center and I'm not going to let you out till you're feeling better or behaving better, I think there'd be a big public outcry about that. But it's not clear that it would produce results. And this is where Marshall Smith, I think, makes some important points. But also Dr. Perry Kendall, who was our provincial health officer, says, we need to stop this argument about you should do this or you should do that, and make sure that anybody who says, I really would prefer to be in a different place, is supported to get to that different place. But we have to be alive to the fact that, sort of like cancer, you can do the treatment, but you may relapse. And, it's that kind of an illness. And people who have struggled with addiction may relapse several times. We just have to become alive to those realities. But it speaks to, my own view is that it speaks to deep dislocations and difficulties in our society, which are there all the time, but are more acute now, certainly more acute since the pandemic. But the risk of unemployment, the sense of insecurity, the fact that more and more people are working precarious jobs. I see more and more guys riding around town on electric bikes carrying pizzas to somebody. Yeah. All of this kind of stuff is part of the problem.
Well, listen, the opioid crisis in the United States. I mean, look at all the pain there was to cover up.
Exactly.
When people had access to that. There's a lot of people out there that, are working through shit. No question about it.
When you talk about addiction and say, well, we're going to treat fentanyl the way we do, and this was a problem, I think, in the dialogue here, that we're going to manage it the way we manage alcohol, it's not an easy comparison. Fentanyl is extremely dangerous and powerful. Alcohol is deadly too, abused, but it's quite difficult to die of alcohol poisoning in about 4 minutes. And so the application of some of the lessons of cigarettes and tobacco are not irrelevant, long conversation, but a very important one. I think it will have political resonance in the coming elections, both provincially and federally.
A dumb question to end on, because I sound like Ronald Reagan, but what are the points of entry of fentanyl and how can we not stop it?
Well, it's fentanyl can be made in labs and is made in labs here in BC and exported. We have a very
innovative... Okay, so it's now an export industry for BC. I thought it was coming in from somewhere.
Oh, no. We're constantly innovating here, David. And, initially, it's made out of... I gather the chemistry is not particularly difficult because the pictures the police release of these labs show people's basements and barns in the countryside in horrible, dirty conditions, and they stir all this stuff together and put it through a pill press, and there we are. Precursors are products I'm not familiar with, but they're not that hard to get. They are needed in the regular economy for other legitimate purposes. But fentanyl, once manufactured, it's a disruptive technology similar to so many of the ones we've seen recently, because it eliminated the entire supply chain. If I can get the precursors into a lab in a barn in Lumbee, BC, I can make enough fentanyl to supply a huge market. And this was a decision that was made by people who were already selling drugs to start adding fentanyl. And it's very, very destructive. So yes, it's coming from China. Yes, it may be coming from Mexico. But yes, we're Canadians. We're plucky. We're competitive in world markets. And we've learned how to make the stuff ourselves, and we're making tons of it. So, this is an issue, I think, that...
So a supply strategy can't work then?
Well, I think it's important, though, to try to interfere and minimally disrupt, but also, if possible, arrest people who are operating these labs. And the police do have some serious organizational problems, but some serious constraints as well in the judicial system. You know, one of the things we hear a lot about from right-wing politicians is the catch-and-release system. So here in BC, people are saying it's David Eby's fault that people get bailed out so readily. But it is extremely difficult to prosecute major drug dealers, and it happens, but it's difficult. And I think that's why a comprehensive approach is needed, and leadership is needed. We just have to be clear-eyed about this stuff. Yes, it's coming in the port. Yes, we should stop Hells Angels from doing certain things at the port they shouldn't be doing. But it's okay, folks. We'll still have loss because we're making tons of it ourselves. And this was the other problem on the safe supply side, is the idea that the Conservatives have, that diversion of certain very small number of addicts in BC are being prescribed opioids, and it's winding up in the illicit market. But it's a drop in the bucket compared to what organized crime is pumping out every day. But that diverted supply is what they focus on. But the bigger problem is one that they don't want to talk about because it's so hard to fix. It's the massive, massive illegal organized crime networks that are they're earning billions of dollars a year from the addiction of British Columbians.
But to loop back to the beginning of our conversation, this issue sounds like a perfect... Experts say things that don't sound like common sense. And so you get a common sense versus experts division, and the Conservatives are exploiting that.
That's right. That's right. And, and the behavior, the rise of encampments, which we're now seeing nationally, I think, but in BC, homeless encampments are everywhere. Once people become seriously addicted, it's very hard for them to maintain any serious housing at all if they have any income. Yeah. So they wind up in encampments. They become centers of crime and violence. People seeing these centers of crime and violence aren't wrong. They need to be dispersed, but you can't just sort of wave a stick.
They're in every park in Canada now.
Yeah, but so where are they going to go? And what's the solution going to be? And it's a monumental problem. The BC government alone has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in incremental spending in each of these fronts, but it's not really having an impact. And what people are noticing is a greater and greater presence of people who are suffering from addiction, who are out of it, like as Canadians will know, sprawled, apparently unconscious, hopefully not dead, right outside SkyTrain stations and that kind of thing.
All right, Jeff, thank you for this. Hurly Burlyites out there, Jeff Meggs is so smart and so thoughtful. Please tune into Hotel Pacifico for your... this kind of wisdom about BC politics, and also look for him occasionally on Air Quotes on our quotes section, and look for him on Substack. Yeah. Jeff, thank you for doing this. Really, I've been fascinated from a distance about what's going on politically. It seems like the province with the most churn going on right now in the country, and thanks for coming here and explaining it. It was great.
Well, they're talking about us doing Hotel Pacifico even daily during the election. I don't know if I can stand the pace, but thanks for having me. This is a topic I can talk on too long, so thanks for having me.
Well, it was great to have you. I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN. Thank all of you Hurly Burlyites out there for watching and listening, and we'll be back next week with some more of this exact quality discussion, so don't miss it. See you then. Hurly Burly, Hurly Burly. Hurly burly.